The Syrian conflict has driven thousands of doctors out of Syria. Many have fled the violence, arriving in Europe as refugees, but many of those that have remained have been systematically targeted by the current regime, either imprisoned or killed. Out of the ashes of the conflict, an underground medical network has slowly developed in its wake. Hello, I'm Annie Waldman, and on today's ProPublica podcast, we're speaking with Ben Taub, a contributing writer for NewYorker.com, who profiled some of the doctors from this underground network and documented how they're keeping clinics open, despite the risk of violence from both the regime and ISIS. Ben, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So first, can you tell us a little bit about what attracted you to this story? Was there something that tipped you off that had developed in the wake of the Syrian conflict?
Over the last couple of years, I've been following the Syrian war quite closely, not with a specific focus on medicine or anything like that, but then the incident that sparked my dive into this specific story was at the end of April this year. The Al-Quds Hospital in Aleppo was bombed and 55 people were killed. And among those killed was a doctor who made the headlines not only because of the death toll, but because he was a beloved pediatrician and he was the only qualified pediatrician in the city. There are other people that are doing pediatric work, but they don't have the formal qualifications. They never completed their degrees. Most of the doctors in Aleppo, as I later found out, are not formally doctors. They're medical students and medical workers who took on the role of doing very serious trauma surgeries because all the qualified doctors, 95%, have left the rebel side of the city. But at the time, this incident made headlines, not because it was especially unique. There have been 365 regime attacks on medical facilities in Syria since the war began, but because the death toll was very high. And soon afterward, I wanted to do a story about medical care in Syria and how do you sustain, when doctors are being targeted, what drives them to keep going and how do they figure out how to care for people when they themselves are under fire. And I had already expressed interest in this topic. I pitched to my editor, but I didn't really have a clear vision for how the story would look until that bombing.
And before you started this, I mean, did you have any experience in any of these field hospitals when you had done reporting in Syria or along the border?
So I lived on the Turkish-Syrian border a little bit in April 2013 and then for the entire summer of 2013 and summer of 2014. But I spent almost no time actually in Syria. I lived in this town called Kilis, from which you could see and hear the bombings every day. It's about 4 kilometers north of the border. It's the main crossing point for Aleppo City. And I only went into Syria a few hundred meters to work in a refugee camp on two occasions. And while I was in that refugee camp, I did visit the refugee camp hospital, but I had never been to an actual field hospital that was under fire and under these conditions at all. You know, I never saw combat in Syria or anything like that. I knew that I was too inexperienced, not only with security and logistics, but also simply with reporting that, you know, I had never really done reporting back in 2013 or frankly in 14. And so my goal was to learn about this without really going in, and I didn't want to endanger local fixers who were being systematically targeted when they were known to have helped foreigners, not only by ISIS, but also by the regime. And I also had this overwhelming fear that if I were to go into Aleppo at a time when I was a pretty inexperienced aspiring journalist, and were I to witness some aspect of the war that really needed to be told, I didn't have the writing toolkit or the rhetorical toolkit or the journalistic chops to be able to tell the story the way it needed to be done so that people would, first of all, read it, but also care and also understand. And so I thought it would almost be unethical for me to go in. And so that was one of the ways that I convinced myself, despite many invitations from a lot of Syrian friends, convinced myself to stay on the Turkish side.
You know, regardless of the experience of a journalist, this conflict is so dangerous for journalists just entering into the country. How did that affect your own process?
So I've written 3 pieces for The New Yorker magazine about Syria, and I've reported all 3 of them from Europe. The first was about the European jihad, basically between 50 and 80 Belgians who were radicalized in a single apartment in Antwerp, who then formed the first cell of ISIS in Syria. At the time, it was called the Mujahideen Shura Council. And it was led by a Syrian jihadi who became Baghdadi's first pledged deputy, who then became the head of the ISIS media department and who was largely responsible for overseeing the hostage crisis. And that was all from Belgium. I spent 6 weeks in Belgium reporting that. And all the stuff from Syria came from Belgian federal police documents that included wiretaps of guys in Syria calling back home and bragging about war crimes, of interrogations. They had hundreds of hours of interrogations of Belgian jihadis who had fought with this group and then returned to Belgium. And so the material that I got in Belgium was far richer than anything I could have found in Syria, and I didn't really take any serious risks. The second project was also entirely done in Europe. I actually can't mention the country for this one because it was a war crimes investigation, and the war crimes investigators that I was profiling have a lot of very serious security concerns. But again, what they did was essentially smuggled 600,000 Syrian government security and intelligence documents out of the country, and they used them to build a case against the government that traces the torture and detention and murder of tens of thousands of people through the chain of command directly to orders that emanated from Assad's highest level security committee, and which were then approved of by Assad himself. And the documents were in this Western European country, so I didn't have to go to Syria for that either. And once again, the material was infinitely more rich than anything I could have found had I gone to Damascus, and I took no risks. This last one was done in London, and I did a lot of interviews, of course, as with all of these, but the first-hand material was this doctor, because he leads surgical training courses, David Knott. He films and photographs everywhere he goes, and so he was often operating with a GoPro camera on his head, and Syrian doctors working in Aleppo hospitals were often taking photographs and sending them to him, asking for surgical advice when he was away. And so he had this collection of 50,000 photos and videos from inside Syrian hospitals. So I largely wrote out of these images that he'd shown me. And so it was, a very low-risk project. I have the highest respect for journalists who cover conflict and go into it and take very serious risks. But I, at this point, I'm 25 years old, and I've been at the fringe of conflict. I've been in a couple of very dicey situations, but I haven't seen any combat, and I don't feel as though, to this point, I haven't been prepared to cover conflict firsthand, but that doesn't mean that you can't report on it. A lot of young journalists who maybe don't have frontline experience, that doesn't mean they should shy away from covering these conflicts. It's just they have to find other ways to get the material that is indisputable evidence, really, a lot of which is making its way into Europe through the refugee stream or through investigations or turning up in European federal police and interrogation reports.
So what attracted you to reporting on Syria? I mean, you started when you were in college.
I was between junior and senior year. I took a year off. I had taken a journalism class my junior spring. I didn't really know what journalism was. I was vaguely attracted to the Middle East because I had chased a girl there the year before and ended up in Cairo about 5 months into the revolution. I couldn't tell if I was more enthralled by her or by what was happening around us. And so when the relationship fizzled, I still maintained the interest in the place. And so I took this journalism class and I just wanted to learn about the Middle East. It was with Deborah Amos, who covers broadly the Middle East, but also was very, very focused on Syria for NPR. And she was the most wonderful mentor, and she guided me, outside of class. And then when I took this year off of school, she continued to guide me. And she ultimately advised me when I was thinking about going to the Turkish-Syrian border for the first time. She gave me a couple of contacts, and she gave me this really, really, really important piece of advice. When the first time that I got an invitation to go into Syria, she wrote to me saying, effectively saying, because I don't want to misstate a direct quote, but she wrote to me effectively saying that when you are making the decision of whether to cross that border or not, think about who will hold the press conference announcing your abduction. And that stopped me cold. And I think that, it's very easy to dive into dangerous situations when you don't really consider how bad they are. And it's very easy to dive into situations even when you do consider how bad they are, but you don't actually know how bad they are. Because you might think that, people are going into Aleppo all the time. At the time, they were. This is early 2013. People were going back and forth, often, sometimes every day, from the Turkish side. But then in May, from May till August, there was just a huge spate of abductions. And there was no way to know that you're safe the moment you cross the border, no matter who you're with.
What was so striking about your piece that I think was the intimacy that you had, not only with your characters, but also with the situation, even though you weren't there on the ground. I'm wondering how you maintained that intimacy and really built those scenes, even though you weren't there.
They were largely written out of photos and videos. So some of the really difficult stuff to read was also, for me, very difficult to watch. When I'm describing surgical procedures, for instance, a surgeon might say, what might describe an entire paragraph that I had written in two words. He'd say, oh, they did a resuscitative thoracotomy. Now, I had no idea what a resuscitative thoracotomy was, so I was watching these videos and describing the steps. What are they doing? And then I would consult with this doctor, David Knott, and he'd tell me, oh, this is what it's the procedure's actually called, and here are the steps, and no, that's the heart, not the lung, and, you know, sort of guiding me on the stuff that I didn't know. But really, the descriptions were step-by-step things that to surgeons are very standard procedures, but to other people, you know, to normal people like me, very new. But there were also a lot of really horrific things besides treating injuries on those videos. Things, you know, aftermaths of barrel bombs attacks, children coming in, you know, torn apart by bombs, and even in some cases it would be possible to save them from their physical wounds, from the blast wounds, but they died anyway because their lungs had filled with concrete from these explosions where they blow up an entire building and the air fills with concrete and then your lungs fill with concrete. So even if you do survive the initial blast and maybe you lose your legs, but you could be saved, often people would die anyway. And so this affected the doctors a lot, of course. And there was one scene that Dr. Knott, he couldn't treat any of the five children who came in, and that was really hard for him. And he filmed the whole scene because he wanted to be able to prove to people how terrible it was. Sometimes I had to watch things many times in order to make sure that they were accurate. And then, of course, you know, one of the fact checkers had to watch it too at the magazine, and it was really hard. It was really hard. But yeah, that's how a lot of the vivid scenes were really just describing things that were captured on camera. It's hard to ignore human rights abuses. And when I started to learn about them, there's no way to look away. And I felt not just personally interested, but also morally obliged to keep working on journalism.
You reported that in the past 5 years, the Syrian government has assassinated, bombed, and tortured to death almost 700 medical personnel, and non-state actors, including ISIS, have killed 27. Do you think that this is unusual for a conflict such as this one, for the medical field to be so specifically targeted?
Yeah, it's unprecedented. Doctors have been targeted in the Bosnian War, in El Salvador. It's not unusual for doctors to be attacked. It is unusual for doctors to be systematically attacked, as the UN determined, this is a quote, as a matter of policy. A policy by a government that participates in the United Nations. It is unprecedented. But what's especially horrifying now in recent years, as this has been allowed to go on by the international community, it started to become more normal. And so now we're seeing doctors and hospitals systematically targeted in Yemen. And hospitals have been bombed in Sudan. And so by allowing this to continue with, frankly, no consequences, it's becoming normal. And medical workers working in conflict zones all over the world are becoming increasingly afraid that they could become targeted and that there will be no consequences for the perpetrators.
Another thing on top of that, what struck me so much about your piece and also the nature of the Syrian conflict in general is just how these basic arms of the government, whether it's the judicial system or the state-run hospitals, become part of the security apparatus of the state. How did this develop over time?
Well, so the security apparatus has been at the core of the Syrian government since, you know, the 70s. And so the structure for the last several decades has been that the National Security Bureau includes the heads of Syria's four intelligence agencies, general security, political security, military intelligence, and Air Force intelligence. And they then have a chairman as well, who, and they meet routinely, and their chain of command essentially extends through all provinces where each branch of each intelligence service has its own head of branch, and then to all the districts and then all the sub-districts. And there's this huge reporting chain back and forth for orders and reports coming back saying that they've been carried out. And this has been true for decades. What changed in early 2011, on March 27th, Assad appointed all of the members of the National Security Bureau, as well as the Minister of Defense, the Minister of Interior, Deputy Minister of Defense, his brother, Maher al-Assad, and a couple of other guys, to form a secret cell called the Central Crisis Management Cell. And this body was charged with overseeing the crackdown. And this was above the National Security Bureau. And so every single night, beginning on March 27th, they had a meeting where they would discuss all the security issues in all provinces, and they were getting these really, really small reports. I mean, meticulous reports, hundreds, thousands of pages, but by small, I mean they were looking at the most boring details and taking them so seriously. One of the members of the crisis cell responded to and requested follow-up for a report that came from 350 miles northeast of Damascus in Deir ez-Zor province of some security agent seeing some graffiti on a water pipe near a highway that said "Down with Bashar." That was passed up the chain to someone in the crisis cell, and then a month later he sent back, you know, a request saying, like, "Did you find the perpetrator?" And the political security agents in Deir ez-Zor province responded, "No, like, we tried, we really tried, but we couldn't find him." I mean, that's how on top of this they were. They were seeing everything, and they passed their meeting minutes every night, where they outlined recommendations for how to deal with each security issue, to Assad himself via a courier who delivered them. And then Assad would review them, go through the recommendations, revise them sometimes just sign off on them, but sometimes make other edits and suggestions and return them for implementation. And so then this would go back down through the chain of command, through the security apparatus that has existed for decades.
Aside from the central government, I mean, how does ISIS also affect these doctors when they're working in the field?
In January 2014, ISIS kidnapped 13 doctors from a Doctors Without Borders facility in northeastern Syria. Eight of them were Syrian doctors, and they were quickly released, but the five foreigners were kept for several months. And when they were eventually released, Doctors Without Borders withdrew its foreign staff from the country. So they continue to operate many medical facilities in Syria, but just they won't go in ISIS territory. And they're all staffed by Syrian doctors. And so the foreign staff is withdrawn completely, and they continue to provide support and supplies. But that gets very difficult when, you know, Aleppo is currently under siege. This happened over the weekend. For years, there's been this one road, Costello Road, the only way to get into Aleppo. And cars would speed down it. And there were large berms of dirt built up on the side of the road to protect them from snipers and view, essentially. And over the weekend, this last weekend, the Syrian government took over Castella Road and blocked it off. And now 300,000 people in Aleppo City, on the rebel side of Aleppo City, have no means of getting more medical supplies into the city, no means of getting more food or any other kinds of supplies. And so we could be looking at an incredibly desperate humanitarian situation. There are about 1 million people living under siege in Syria, almost all of them in government areas, but there are several thousand, perhaps even tens of thousands, who are under siege, besieged by rebel groups. But the overwhelming majority are besieged by the government. And some of those sieges have gone on for 4 years. But the siege of Aleppo is of a scale that is hard to imagine quite how bad the humanitarian consequences will be. Before the war, it was Syria's most populous city.
Some have described a sense of media fatigue, which essentially means that readers have become exhausted or desensitized to the horrific reporting in Syria and how it's and essentially tune it out. I mean, do you think this is true? Do you think that there should be more reporting on it, or the reporting
I think there should be more reporting on Syria. It's very easy to report on ISIS these days because ISIS broadcasts all of its crimes. Syrian government hides all of its crimes and then denies them, even when they're documented to a degree that hasn't existed in any other conflict ever, on filming and also with internal regime documents that have been smuggled out of the country by this group, the Commission for International Justice and Accountability, that I profiled in April. So it's harder to work on government crimes, but as a government, they can achieve a magnitude of criminality that ISIS could only dream of. There was a recent Monitor report that said that 60,000 people have been killed in Syrian government detention facilities. Hundreds of thousands have been detained illegally for long periods of time, tortured, but 60,000 of those have been killed. There are 50,000 photographs taken inside these facilities, in the Caesar Collection, it's called, where the overwhelming majority are photographs of detainees who have been tortured to death, starved to death, assassinated, you name it. I mean, melted. It's not as if this evidence doesn't exist. It's just, and there are reporters that are covering this very, very thoroughly. There are many of them, and they have been covering it for years. I mean, Anne Barnard at the New York Times, Liz Sly at the Washington Post, they've been doing a really tremendous job on this all the way through. But somehow it doesn't quite get the attention from the public that it needs to. I think it does come down to ISIS being a slightly more dramatic topic because they're a lot less complicated than the Syrian government when it comes down to like goodness and badness. Syrian government is made up of tens of thousands of, perhaps hundreds of thousands of bureaucrats who are just doing their job, who are in a position, were they to voice dissent, of having their family members killed. And there are a lot of really, really good people who have very, very legitimate fears that were the regime to fall, their families might be killed by terrorist groups. That's very true. But the criminality and the brutality at the core of the Syrian government, at the highest level of the Syrian government, is indisputable. And when the political situation changes enough that the International Criminal Court does perhaps one day have jurisdiction over crimes committed by all parties, those leaders will have a really hard time building a defense.
So do you have any advice for young reporters or reporters generally who are looking to report on Syria?
There's such a volume of material that it's not hard to learn about what's going on, but there's also a huge volume of disinformation coming out as well, very deliberate stuff, especially out of the Russian camp. And I would suggest downloading every report from the UN Commission of Inquiry and reading it start to finish. Some of those are hundreds of pages, some of those are a few dozen pages, but they are filled with material that was written contemporaneously. So often stuff from 2012, 13, before ISIS was really existing, certainly before it was a problem. And that gives a very clear picture of what this is all about.
Ben, I can't thank you enough for coming in. So thanks
thank
so
you.
Much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the podcast, and we'll be back next week.